You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Holly Peterson.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you've never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. We look at all of this and more from a long-term strategic view, how to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Holly Peterson on the show with me. She has a fantastic new book called It's Hot in the Hamptons. And if you're looking for a great summer read, this should be at the top of your list. Welcome to the show, Holly.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you. Holly, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow. I wanted to be a TV producer, and I wanted to work for Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters because I was kind of a news hound in my early teens. And I was a Russian language scholar of sorts. Calling myself a scholar is a stretch, but I did take Russian language all through high school and college. And that was, you know, in the late 80s. Right before 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell down, all six Warsaw Pact countries and, you know, the former Soviet Union just completely collapsed with various types of revolutions. So, you know, I always cared about the news. I always cared about politics. I always cared about policy. And I wanted to work originally in the news business and tell stories that I thought needed to be told.
That is a very specific memory. Rarely does someone have a memory that specific of wanting to be a news producer and to influence the story of the news that we see every day. I love that.
Well, it was a lot of fun. You know, I got to ABC in 1989, and you know, my area, which was Russian and Russia, was blowing up. It was like speaking Arabic, you know, during the Gulf War or something. I mean, just everybody needed me, even if I was the lowliest person on the staff making the least money, which I certainly was. I did feel needed. And then, of course, we had, you know, the Gulf War I in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And then we had O.J. Simpson. And then we had Tanya Harding and Nancy I mean, we had crazy stories in the 90s. So I was very grateful to be part of Television Network News at the time.
I graduated high school in 1989, and I remember the fall of the Soviet Union and the wall coming down. Those were very definitive, points for my generation. And what an exciting time to be making news and to get to be on that side, telling the story. Did you ever consider that as storytelling? Did you compare what you did then to the what you do now? Do you feel a connection there between the two?
There's a total connection, and you're asking really good questions. The journalism is the first rough draft of history if it's done right. Okay, so if you're at a coup, if you're at the 2000 crazy election, if you're at the OJ trial, if you're at so many different things, you are the first person writing it down for history, and then historians and scholars go back and, you know, fix and amend and add to whatever you've done. So it is a very strong form of storytelling. And when I do, and then I worked at, you know, I worked at ABC News for 10 years, then I worked as an editor at Newsweek and for various other magazines. And in my 40s, I've kind of done different things each decade. My 40s, I started writing books, but I call my books, Hank, journalistic fiction. Because having spent 20 years in the news business, I would never right, you know, when you read a book or you see a movie and you're like, oh, Jesus, that wouldn't happen. You know, I don't think anyone's really going to do that with my books. And also, I fact check my books. I mean, I get super into what's the name of this and did this happen in this year? And, you know, I just would never put anything that's wrong in any of my books. So my writing is all very linked from fiction to nonfiction, back to fiction, blah, blah, blah.
I'm really fascinated by the intersection of different types of artistic expression. And there's this really strong link between journalists and fiction writers, that some of the best fiction writers began their careers in journalism. Do you think that your time as a journalist has honed your senses as a fiction writer? Do you think that as a journalist you learn to pick out details and things like that that other people miss?
I mean, 100%. I write social satire, okay? And I've written 4 novels. The first one was The Manny, which was very, you know, a big book like 10 years ago. And then I wrote The Idea of Him, which wasn't that successful. And then I wrote, I mean, I liked it. I thought it was my best book. Then I wrote It Happens in the Hamptons. And this one is called It's Hot in the Hamptons that just came out. And I feel that I'm telling a story that isn't told properly. I grew up with a fair amount of privilege because my father was a self-made man and an important banker. And, you know, he grew up in a Greek diner, but he became an important person. And, you know, most journalists don't live or didn't see what I saw in terms of New York City privilege. And so I feel like I have this really unique perch from which to report that most journalists can't report from. Most of the times when people write about rich people, you know, it's just caricature. It's like bad, mean Cruella de Vil characters. And I'm not saying they're not like crazy people, but they're not like that. And I tell stories in Town and Country in the New York Times, and I've done 2 columns for the Financial Times now. You know, I tell a journalistic tale of life inside, you know, privilege and wealth and the maniacs that run around in that world, because it's a very strange breed of people, especially as, you know, inequality reigns so deeply in our society and around the world. The 1% is becoming the 0.001%, you know, and that story has to be told because it's, you know, it's unfair and it's not good for society. And I feel like just the details are kind of fun to explain from a social satire point, but I'm always making a bigger point about what is success really, and what is happiness really, and what is life in a bubble like, and is this something we should all want, and is society better if we're all a little more equal, and, you know, just other things than the exact shoe or the heel that I'm writing about. There's always something deeper in all my books, I hope. I know. I mean, I hope, you know, my readers think that.
I think it's important to distinguish between caricature and true satire. But because to me, for satire to really work and to really hit home, it really needs to cut close to the bone. Whereas it's easy to dismiss these over-the-top characters, these Cruella de Vils, as you used, because they're so over-the-top. And, well, these people aren't truly real because they're, you know, this is so overblown. When you're writing social satire, how do you make sure that you don't overcompensate these characters to the point of unbelievability?
I mean, I'm not even compensating. I'm just telling the truth, you know? I mean, wealthy, successful men in particular, not to be sexist, but I think this to be true because there's more rich guys in finance than rich women. It's just the way the world works, unfortunately. I find a lot of them to be anxious, unhappy, neurotic, never satisfied, you know, not particularly self-aware. And I'm not compensating for anything, and I'm not overdoing anything. I'm just saying it as it is. These guys, you know, to get that level of success and to maintain it is kind of very, very difficult. And it makes the human psyche that does it kind of crazy because they just never have enough and they want more. And it's this just incredibly competitive kind of vicious game they're playing that, you know, affects their psyche, affects their relationships. All kinds of things.
So what's the progression from going from TV news to written journalism to now writing these types of books? Was it the types of stories that kept evolving? I know you mentioned the OJ case and you know, we really start peeling back the layers of kind of the weirdnesses in our society there. And what was the progression that led you to these types of books?
Well, I think most people's careers have an element of luck, if they're lucky, you know. But I also think there's something about earning your luck in the sense that if you're in the right place in the right time and you take advantage of it, it's not as lucky as it seemed at the time. And I've always been someone who is very agile. I'm very, you know, I travel in a lot of different circles. I surf a lot. So I hang out in a lot of different local kind of beach surfer populations, and I travel a fair amount, and I travel in New York in the media circles and also some of the fancy circles, you know, and they're all very different. So I'm kind of cool with all of it. And, you know, I think that that agility, that social agility, is present in my writing, because writing is really your personality, you know? And so I'm good with kind of crazy TV news and watching videos and figuring out the best words. I'm also pretty good at reading something and knowing if it's interesting or not as an editor in a magazine. And I don't honestly think I'm like a fabulous novelist. I think I'm a good novelist. I think my books are hugely entertaining, kind of fast paced, kind of funny, fun romps. I mean, I just don't think I'm like some great level of literary person is all, is what I mean. But I think that I'm willing to do different things and put myself in different situations, and I enjoy that kind of human process. And I'm not shy, and like powerful people don't scare me, and big waves don't scare me. And so it's all kind of just part of my personality to kind of jump through different things. Now, there's some people that are frankly much more diligent than I am, and, you know, just spend years on a writing project. You know, I think people like that, you can't just plop that person in a TV edit room and say, you know, go do, you know, an obituary in 4 hours and throw it on the air with Diane Sawyer. I mean, you know, people, some people are comfortable with change. Some people are comfortable with adaptation, and some people aren't. So I would say I am.
I like the idea of social agility as opposed to being a chameleon. I think we know, we can all point to a person who is a completely different person depending on what crowd they're around. But the ability to connect with people from different walks of life and still be who you are is a real gift to a writer.
I think it is a gift. I think that you have to see people as humans and as, you know, flawed and as usually, for the most part, trying their best. So you have to have a lot of empathy. I mean, I've got three teenagers. We're having a big family meeting tonight because all of them are in massive trouble. But, you know, I know they're trying their best. You know, it's just they slip sometimes. They get a little too excited when they're together, you know, blah, blah, blah. But so I think empathy comes in a lot, too. And seeing people's flaws as they're trying hard, but they just didn't do the right thing at that moment, you know?
Empathy, especially when you're dealing with a population like you're dealing with in the Hamptons books, it would be so easy for the other 99% of us to just completely turn our nose up and not feel like we could connect to these characters at all. Yet you find a way for us to start to blend in with them and to understand some of what's going on with these characters. What was the motivation for It Happens in the Hamptons? Where did that story come from for you?
Okay, well, this is an interesting answer, I think. First of all, as I said, I'm writing social satire, and I'm depicting the 1% because I think that's a story that has to be told. So I do feel some journalistic desire and obligation to tell it right and to tell the story of the madness of private planes and all this stuff. That's number one. But number two, you know, coming off Me Too, as in hashtag Me Too, I felt like that is such an important thing for women in the workplace in terms of being abused or harassed or attacked or unfairly treated or paid less or all the different things that encompass a Me Too moment. But I felt what was missing from that is kind of women's sexual agency. When does a woman actually feel in control of her sexuality, and when does she use it, and when does she not feel threatened, and how does that work? Because that it also happens with women. I mean, we're not all like the victims or the survivors of rough treatment. Sometimes life is better than that. And sometimes we are in charge of our own destiny and our own sexuality. And so I really wanted that story told. And so Hank, this book is really about two women who are mothers and wives who have affairs. Their husbands have been cheating on them a long time, but the wives decide they're going to spend the summer attempting to have an affair because kind of it's not really revenge with the husbands. It's more parity. You know, they want to be equal and they want to do what the husbands have been doing to see what it feels like. So that's really why I wrote this book. And I also feel, Hank, that, you know, as a feminist and as a watcher of female gender roles and character, that you never really see a good mom and a good wife who's cheating. You know, I'm not pro-affair at all, but that character you don't really see written. You often see the woman punished, like Anna Karenina or Scarlet A or Drinking Arsenic or that movie with Richard Gere when he bashes in her lover's head and, like, takes charge. You don't really see a woman having dalliances and not being judged or punished for it because it's just not a character that Hollywood wants to have. And I wanted to write that character because I don't see it that often. And there's ramifications and there's problems with having an affair. And as I said, I'm not pro-affair, but I wanted to see how that played out with two women cheating who were good moms and good wives in every other, you know, way.
What surprised you about writing this book when you start exploring those ideas and those concepts? Were you taken by surprise in places that the story went?
You know, I think women are caretakers and hearth tenders in our souls. And I think that that makes us, you know, want to do the right thing and kind of care for people and want to make sure that our interactions with them are thoughtful. And I know a lot of men are like that too. And a lot of women are super tough and really abrasive and not like that. But I think in general, women tend to worry and be anxious about how they're portrayed and what their interactions are with someone and what the fallout is going to be. So, you know, to the extent that a man can have an affair with his secretary or masseuse or some lady he met on a business trip and kind of semi be cool with it, I don't really think my women characters weren't cool with it. They're really nervous about it. And, you know, I have a chapter called "What Apple Engineers Really Want You to Get Caught." I mean, it's basically impossible not to get caught cheating. Between the toll block thing on your windshield to your backup camera to your conversation on your phone and Bluetooth going into the car that just drove by, that, you know, I mean, there's just so many ways. All your photos. You ever notice all your photos are on your Apple TV when your Apple TV is resting, right? It's like, when did you ever say yes to that, you know? So I think with all the privacy or lack of privacy, I think having an affair these days is a very complicated venture. And it's, again, not something I'm for, but I think it's super hijinks. And super hijinks makes for a good novel. And so I think it's hot in the Hamptons. I think it's a good book. I honestly think it's a good book. I think it's very realistic about women trying something out, you know, post Me Too. Definitely major consequences that you'll read. And it's a romp within a world of kind of mad privilege. But it's also in a summer community. So the 99% is alive and well in this book too. It's not all like inside these people's fancy dressing rooms. It's also how people are treated by them. And there's, you know, a lot of local characters too.
Well, the great thing about fiction is it allows us to play the what if game and put ourselves in situations that most of us would never find ourselves in. And to start kind of unraveling consequences that, you know, outside of there actually being consequences. It's really interesting the way you turn the tables and start exploring what would happen if the people that are not expected to behave this way begin to behave this way. And I think it tells us a lot about ourselves and society and the expectations we put on one another. And being kind of funny and satire, there's a lot to weigh at the end of this book and to kind of sit with. Is that something that you think about when you're writing the kind of lasting impact of the story?
You mean the effect that it might have on someone?
Right. As the reader, that we're left with these characters that we're sort of still empathizing with.
I mean, that's the number one game. You know, the number one game is creating characters that people care about and can relate to. There's a man named Nick Pileggi. I think he wrote Goodfellas, but he certainly wrote like 15 fabulous, important movies. He's one of them, very important screenwriter. And he said the greatest character ever created was Tony Soprano, because you really cared about him. He was, you know, whacking people and killing people and bludgeoning people, but he also went to a shrink. You know, so you really cared about him. And, you know, you have to care about the characters and you have to relate to something about the characters. And of course, they have to be flawed. They don't have to bludgeon people, but they have to make a lot of mistakes, because we all make a lot of mistakes. And, you know, I mean, that's what I try to do. I try to create characters people care about that are totally realistic. But I would like to say, excuse me, just one sec. I would like to say the likability factor can get a writer in trouble with a character. Because if you're trying to write something that's likable, then it gets a little corny and, you know, silly and ooky and annoying, you know? So you have to be very careful about worrying about making someone likable.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because, you know, there's a whole school of thought in writing, you know, the whole save the cat thing, where, you know, they teach that you should have likable characters from the very beginning. And if your character is not likable enough, have them save an actual cat. And, you know, to build this trust and likability with the readers, are there any things that you do specifically to counteract that, to make sure that we're not empathizing and sympathizing too much with the character?
Wow. I think that the dialogue is really important. I think that the way characters say how they are feeling about something or what they're anxious about is incredibly important. And I think that's really what draws the reader in and is going to have that lasting effect you're talking about, because it's very hard in third person not to get too much expositional, if that's a word. You know, there's exposition makes the reader pull back and action pulls the reader in. And I feel that very strongly when I'm reading a book and the writer is just explaining too much and you're not there, I pull back. I'm not that interested. But when they're talking about something or they're doing something, that's when I feel really gripped by it. So my dialogue is really important, and I think my dialogue is good. I'm happy with my dialogue. But I think that's the key to making the characters likable and relatable.
Right. This book, It's Hot in the Hamptons, and the previous book, It Happens in the Hamptons, really used this the setting as a springboard for these kind of fantastical tales and people that most of us will never encounter. Does the setting of the Hamptons kind of become a metaphor for excess and this sort of lifestyle that is other?
100%, because I always say, as summer communities are testosterone fueled inequality, because most summer communities, unless it's some really weird, like, you know, movie thriller island with serial killers all over in the winter, you know, unless it's like, you know, some American coast or mountain town or something like this, right? Or lakeside community. Most of those towns have a vibrant local community. They've got teachers and schools and firemen and painters and architects and builders and, you know, all kinds of people, right? And most people, 99% probably, don't have a second home in this country. You know, they have one home and then they maybe go on vacation if they're lucky. But, you know, they don't have two big homes. And so these rich people go into this, you know, vibrant local community like an invading army. And they take over the restaurants and they drive badly and they act like jerks and they cut lines and they just are entitled people. And so it just creates a ton of friction between the local community and the summer community. And that's, you know, that's the kind of friction that I'm always looking for. It Happens in the Hamptons, which I published 2 years ago, really came off 99% and 1%. It really, because that dialogue was really happening in America at that time. I mean, it's been happening basically since Occupy Wall Street for a long time. But 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, there was a lot of discussion about CEO salaries and the rising inequality and the differences in our society and how the 1% is so much richer than everyone else. And that's really that was the theme of that book, is the 1% and the 99% clashing. The theme of this book, even though it's within this world of clashing, you know, economic backgrounds, is about women's sexual agency, as I said, but that's coming off Me Too. Hashtag Me Too.
The first book, It Happens in the Hamptons, is kind of a macrocosm view, and It's Hot in the Hamptons is kind of a zoomed in microcosm of kind of what this scenario, this inequality looks like, and then how we can flip the tables. When you're dealing with big subjects like that, and then smaller, more personal subjects like this, you play out what the consequences are and what the what our actions do. How do you portray those things without becoming preachy and without becoming moralistic, if that's a good way to say that?
No, I think you're asking really excellent questions. That's one of the main problems. And difficulties I do have, which is, you know,
something when we're dealing with something that we care about, it's so easy to go there.
Yeah, it's easy to go there, and it's easy to go too far in teasing, right? Like tone. You're really talking about tone. Tone is very important, and you know, I always talk about the Samantha character, who was that sex crazed lady in Sex and the City. You know. She was so crazy, but you were in a party with her, and you were, you know, Sex and the City was a big party, right? So while it was making fun of these women to some extent, and some of them were a little exaggerated in their kind of role models within that quartet of women, it was a good feeling, you know, and it was a romp, and it was a party that we were invited to, and they were drinking Cosmos and wearing Manolo Blahniks, and it was fun. And in my book, I really try to emulate that tone of you're invited to a party. All right, now we're going to go into a beach party at one of these rich people's house. All right, now we're going to go to lunch with them. Now we're going to go to a trunk show at some stupid lady's house. Now we're going to do this. Now we're going to do that. You know, and it's not like these people are jerks. Like the readers can roll their eyes at the characters if they want to, but I really try not to say that or to be too preachy, as you say, or to judge too much because you know, they speak for themselves. If the dialogue's good and the situation's good and it's totally realistic and believable, then the audience is going to make, you know, smart, justified opinions on what the life is like and what they think about it.
What do you think is the next great fodder for social commentary and satire?
I think I'm going to do the art world next.
Nice.
The art world has become totally international. Art has become an asset class, as you know, Wall Street guys would say, because you can buy and sell a painting on so many websites and in so many auctions in Hong Kong and you know all over the world without even sending your piece there. That you know, it's kind of like the art world is kind of like Amazon now, or like. What's that site where you sell things? Where you like sell your lawn chair and stuff? What's that thing?
Like eBay?
Yeah, like eBay. I mean, the art world is not like Amazon. The art world's like eBay now, where you can just put something up and see who wants to buy it. And so I think that creates a lot of, as I said, friction about what is a commodity and, of course, what is art? And then, of course, who creates art? And then, of course, who says this is art? And then, of course, is that person some pretentious jerk who doesn't know what they're talking about? Yes, you know, all of the above. And what kind of art has staying power? And what kind of art resonates? And who's a total poser? And who acts like they're chic and cultured and aren't? And, you know, you can just, I could just go on with a billion questions like that. All of that is very, very present in the art world. So.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. I can't wait to see what you do with it, Holly. The new book, It's Hot in the Hamptons, is out everywhere now in paperback and audiobook and ebook, if that's how you like to consume books. Holly, this has been so much fun talking. Is there a place where people can find you online if they want to learn more about you, dig into all the work that you do and get into your back catalog?
Sure. I have a website, hollypeterson.com, HollyPeterson.com, and it's got basically every piece I ever wrote and tons of my ABC Russia pieces on there and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So everything's on there if you want to delve into this world a little bit and look at Town and Country or the New York Times or various places I've written about this stuff that's more journalistic.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of It's Hot in the Hamptons. Holly, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for supporting authors.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
He was just 7 when his parents died. Eliza received the news of their death on Halloween morning, but she kept it from Jason for 2 more days. She sent him out trick-or-treating. He was a vampire. He spun around in the living room, eyes wild, shouting, "I am the living dead!" and wondering why they didn't laugh. On November 2nd, after school, Eliza told him. His parents were dead. It was a bleak time. He wanted silence. He wanted darkness. He cried great, rolling tears. In early spring, he ran away from home, which means he stole $5, put a box of Cheez-Its in a pillowcase, and walked 7 blocks. He slept in a field, glad to be miserable. He wanted to freeze to death, to be with his mom and dad, to not feel anything. His grandmother found him at a playground near the river, fallen in the dust with his shoulder against the slope of a teeter-totter, the other end riderless, suspended. He saw her trudging up the hill. She looked twice her usual size in her winter coat, and frightening. "Let's go home, Jason." He knew he was in trouble. He knew what home meant. It meant a paddling, or worse. Eliza opened her big winter coat and, straining, slipped down into the dust next to him. She drew him into her warm body, wrapping him in the coat. She flipped the collar up, rubbed her hands together, and cupped them over his ears.
"Brr, you're an ice cube, but it feels good, kinda. It's good to get really cold sometimes. Wakes you up."
They were cheek to cheek against the teeter-totter, bundled together as the sky turned from gray to orange. The ground stung, but they sat a long time.
"Why?"
The word was just a tiny puff of vapor that slipped from his lips and into the wind, but it was also big, big and heavy. She knew what his little boy heart had asked. She understood the universe of longing and confusion and hurt in that one whispered word.
"We all die, baby. In all the long, long history of the world, there's not been one of us who didn't." "I'll die," he said.
It wasn't a question, but it was.
"Yes, and I'll die. A lot sooner. And the why is just... it's just there. It just is. We're not around to see what was before us, and we're not here to see what happens after."
The trees on the edge of the playground shivered with dawn.
"But we're here now,"
she said, and pulled him tighter until his cheekbone felt sore from pressing against hers.
"And it has to be enough. It has to be. Look at all we have now. Really look."
He really looked. It was just a small playground off the main road of an unimportant New England town. But in the distance he could see the wide Kennebec River, and the sky was pink above it. He saw small ships moored, trimmed in red and baby blue, rocking against the current. He saw a robin on the railing of a dock, toes pointed inward, making occasional hops that were also flight. The town was waking up. There was a light in the bakery and one in the grocery. There was an empty can of beer on a picnic table and wildflowers by the road. There was wind and trees swaying gently. There was his own breath in his own lungs. There was his grandmother, her body, her heartbeat against his back as he leaned against her chest. There was his own life and hers and a world to live them in. And it was enough.